This is the Mike Garrigan Podcast.
Welcome to episode 23 of 24 in the Transitions Podcast series from MikeGarrigan.com. My name is Mike Garrigan. Track 13 in Greensboro is a decent rehearsal space. There was a time over 20 years ago when there was no track 13. If my brother Joe and I wanted to jam, we did so in a rental space in Greensboro. I lived in Chapel Hill at the time in a dorm, and Joe had the drum set, so it made sense for Joe to host the sessions at a space. Both of us were on a college budget, and the space we used was grimy, dirty, and stinky. The carpet on the floor and the walls absorbed sound well, but it also took in the pleasant aroma of cigarette smoke, beer, and bathroom. One afternoon, Joe and I decided to play through some of our favorites from over the years, including a few band renditions of some of my acoustic songs that I was playing as a freshman in college. And at the end of the session, I decided that we were going to go for Broke, and I was going to go into Smells Like Teen Spirit, which is a fun song to play, but it's a step and a half high out of my range, but I went for it anyway, and I made it. And I thought, wow, I'm 19 years old, I'm invincible, and I can sing just like Kurt Cobain. On the drive back to Chapel Hill, I noticed that I couldn't sing along with my Discman like I could on the way to Greensboro. I had sung from the throat, and I had completely lost my voice. It was Thursday, and I had a gig at Columbia Street Bakery on Saturday. What happens when you strain your voice from shouting? Your larynx becomes swollen and raw. It's called laryngitis, the same condition that is caused by bacterial and viral infections, except in this capacity, the swelling is caused by trauma, and over time, continual poor vocal technique can lead to nodules, which are hard calloused growths on the voice box. And having knots on your vocal cords ruins your voice, your range, and if you have a singing career, that too. After that incident at the practice space, I did very little talking that Friday and Saturday, and I played my best on Saturday night, and there's nothing like a little adrenaline to clear up the remnants of laryngitis. I did fine, but it wasn't without stress. From that moment on, I began to explore this idea that that I had heard about called singing from the gut. And this is when a singer's sense of power comes not from the head and not from the throat and not even from the lungs, but from deep down around the belly button in the diaphragm area. And it's hard to describe, but you know it when you do it. It feels as if you are pushing the contents of your lungs through your stomach and up and over your vocal cords, and you vibrate them in the process. You're doing it right if your voice has vibrato without thinking about vibrato consciously. You're just, it's vibrating because it's moving the air in the right way. This technique is in stark contrast to throat singing, which is like setting off a bomb in your throat. If the voice box is a muscle, think about singing like lifting weights. Singing from the gut is like using proper form, going slow and growing and making substantial regular gains. Singing from the throat is like lifting with poor form, with too much weight, and with injury in sight. Since that night at the rehearsal space, I've only lost my voice on one other occasion, Collapsus had played a gig at Auburn University, and the room was very cold where we played, and it was summer outside, very hot, and some mix of temperature change, fatigue, and overuse had caused a weird case of laryngitis. And the next day, we almost canceled our City Stages set in Birmingham, but went to a Doc in the Box and got a shot in the butt of adrenaline. And the large crowd in front of us also helped me clear up my voice real quick by necessity. Having good vocal technique is more important than ever nowadays. In the past 10 years, as venues have transitioned from supporting original music and shorter sets to cover bands with full night-long engagements, singers are generally having to sing longer than ever. This is, of course, assuming that your markets are shifting this way. I'm sure in larger cities where original music thrives, this is less of an issue. In the 90s, the longest I would be asked to play was for 90 minutes. And the last few non-traditional gigs I've done, I guess in the past couple years, have asked for upwards of 3 hours of music, and they've requested half covers and half originals, with the covers preferred. Learning proper vocal technique, like anything, is a trial and error thing. Lessons can help, but these sessions, singing lessons, err on the side of teaching common techniques in favor of developing a signature style or voice, for lack of a better term. Many singers I've recorded over the years who have a bit of formal training tend to have a better sense of pitch than those who have learned on their own. I'm not sure if someone with excellent native pitch seeks out lessons to begin with, or if the lessons help. The lessons will help with learning gut singing and how to transition between the different voices you have, and also general vocal maintenance. My technique is a soft conversational style with occasional bursts of power or outbursts of shouting. I think this is how I'm able to sing for hours at a time with little or no vocal fatigue. My style is anything but formal and is a reflection of the kinds of songs that I write. At times, admittedly, my peers have criticized me directly for being a soft singer, but I have to disagree. I sing like I play the guitar, usually reserved unless more is required. I think being on 10 all the time is like being at zero all the time. I like dynamics. I sang for the first time in my first band, the KDF. We had entered a talent show, and instrumental music was disallowed. We had worked up a, well, interesting cover of The Cure's Just Like Heaven. We had three guitars, a Casio keyboard, and a snare drum. I knew the song, and I just kind of stepped up to the mic and started singing, and I wasn't expecting to sing in the audition. I can't remember, but I think after the audition, we made the audition, but the organization sponsoring the talent show may have asked me not to sing in in the actual show. I think it was that bad. My mom still cries when we bring up this show and how bad it was. But from then on, I would spend an hour or two after school every day singing and playing my guitar. My technique was awful, but I enjoyed singing a lot. And by the time I was a rising senior in high school, a bunch of us who were at Governor School, we just sat around and sang songs pretty much all the time. I mean, we'd sing Pearl Jam songs and Jane's Addiction songs and Soundgarden songs just endlessly. That's all we did that summer. It was great. Later that fall and spring, when I started driving to school and around and about, I'd sing along in the car all the time. My favorite two recordings to sing along with were REM Unplugged from 1991 and an audio dub of REM's tour film, which incidentally was recently re-released as a full concert on the special edition of Green. When I got tired of singing the lead parts on the tapes, I began to explore harmony lines with these recordings, and REM was a good source for this because their melodies are strong, but the melodies, they aren't dependent on harmonies, and I learned that going a third above or a third below the melody yields a basic, pleasing harmony. And sometime after my 19th birthday, I'm not exactly sure when, but I developed out of nowhere a falsetto. It just kind of happened one day, and I think this grew out of attempting to use the proper voice mechanics. It wasn't until I started hanging out with John Gillespie, Mark Cano, and Nick Brown that I developed a sense of what singing does. And we all played in a side band called the Happy Annies, in which I played acoustic guitar and sang, John played bass and sang, Mark played guitar and sang, and Nick played the drums. Everyone benefited from this group in so many ways. Basically, though, John and I got to play our songs with a band, and Mark and Nick got to play and record in a band setting that wasn't their main band, Athenaeum, and this gave them more recording experience and a different context in which to be creative. It was on John's songs that the harmonies did something remarkable. My range is about a fifth higher than John's, and Mark's range is about a fifth lower than John's, and when Mark would sing a low harmony, I would occasionally chime in above it all, sometimes singing just one note or other times moving with the melody. The Happy Annies only played a handful of times. One of those times was at the Lessons of Autumn CD release party. We played a good mix of John's songs and my songs that night, and the best part of the night, harmony-wise, was our cover of Tommy James and the Shandells' Crimson and Clover. The last part of that song where you sing, quote, Crimson and Clover over and over, end quote, over and over and over, it went on for a long time, but I think everyone sort of felt it and felt why we were doing it. The harmony between the voices, the guitar and the bass, and even the drums elevated to a point that I've very rarely experienced in music. It was a good moment.
Got a habit of losing control of his sanity, changing the shape of reality when she's gone. And she's got a job, but not like the ones in the magazine. That you're gone, he said, shamelessly wasting away, fill the dark with your breath and stay here. But she's got a penchant for changing the shade of her indigo, bleaching the place where like sun on the back of a movie screen, like kites crashing down in the wettest dreams of her. All the time that you're gone, she said,
next year, when John and I began recording demos with Scott Carl, this was the earliest incarnation of Collapsus, I applied the basic harmony principles that I had picked up in the Happy Annies to the new songs that I had brought in. And this sense of harmony, it totally carried me through the record I did in 2012 called Pillar of the Sun. That was my sixth solo album and everything in between there. So, the foundations were far-reaching in my career. On the last record I did, however, The Echoes of Winter, I experimented with an Antares harmony engine, which integrated a given melody with underlying chords, and it suggests several parts at once. And I use this to generate the parts at the end of the song Silver Screen, which I then overdubbed after generating the part electronically. It was a very strange way to work, but it was a different harmony perspective. Singing is part technique and part response. The technique part I've kind of described. How a singer responds to her environment is just as critical as how she sings. In a basic sense, this refers to how a singer perceives the relative pitch of the song she sings, as well as the context for her singing. In a basic singing room scenario, say like a practice room or a choir room, response isn't really an issue. I mean, people will sing together and they respond to the intoned pitch, and they resonate together, and after some practice, even amateur singing groups often sound quite good. The two places where this changes are in the live setting, when there's amplification involved, and then in the recording studio. Have you ever been baffled when an otherwise competent singer that you've paid good money to see perform sounds flat all night long? It's not you, and it's not the singer. It's probably the monitor mix. When a singer hears too much of himself over the accompaniment, there's a psychological tendency to pull flat. All things being equal, the singer thinks he is singing in pitch, but is compensating for the imbalance. The same thing happens when the accompaniment is too loud, except the singer will often trend sharp. And the solution to this common problem is to spend adequate time getting a monitor mix, as well as feedback from the front-of-house engineer when you're playing live, as to how everything sounds. Now, if you have children, you may want to cover their ears. Seriously. Last warning. Not that I'm going to curse or anything, but I have to let the cat out of the bag. Do you know what a perfect monitor mix Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy have in common? Well, none of them exist, at least in this practical sense. These monitoring issues are more common in festival scenarios when the monitor mix is just kind of thrown together and shows up and you'd have to deal with it. And after a few minutes into the song, you can kind of get it worked out. But sometimes there just isn't time to tweak out a monitor mix, and you have to do the best you can. My method, my little secret that I've kept over the years, my dirty little secret for being able to sing in tune in otherwise hostile environments like festivals and clubs where there's no monitors is I always wear earplugs when I play. When I wear earplugs, I'm able to hear my voice in my head, and I can feel the rumble of the bass and the guitars with it. This method took me a few months to perfect, and I attribute this method to my softer singing, too. In later years, it got to the point where I would just make sure some sound was coming through the monitor, and I would say, sure, sounds good. Let's move on to balancing things for the greater good of the band rather than just working on my monitor mix. Getting the balance right in the studio stems from the same issue, but in the studio, you can take 10 minutes or so to get a killer cue mix going for your client, save it as a preset, and then when they walk in for subsequent sessions, it's perfect for their voice, sound, and volume. Pitch awareness comes from surrounding yourself with music, singing a lot, playing music a lot, listening to music whenever possible. Recording yourself is a good way to evaluate your pitch. It takes a few years to get used to hearing yourself on playback, but trust me, it does get better. I used to want to go hide in the other room when Conrad would solo my voice during the Building a Hole sessions. I didn't honestly like the sound of my voice until The Promise of Summer, some 8 years later, so it took a while to get used to it. An opera singer in Greensboro gave singing lessons to a few of my recording clients about 3 or 4 years ago. And she would instruct these singers to think about approaching pitch as a bird landing on a branch. If the bird comes in too low, he won't make it. If he comes in too high, he'll just fly right by it. This visualization is a good exercise for training the mind-voice connection to sort of not swim for the pitch when you're singing. The funny thing is, whenever I've worked with a singer and we look at pitch correction, the graph visually shows the difference between a pitch solid singer and a swimming singer. The modern trend of auto-tuning vocals is ruining the humanity that used to be reflected in older recordings. After working with an outlaw country artists for a few days, when I listen to the Beatles the next day, for example, the Beatles sound horribly out of tune, which by natural standards just isn't true. Artists that don't need autotune sometimes succumb to the allure of pitch correction. I have a hard time listening to REM's Reveal album because Stipe's wavering pitch is part of why I like his singing to begin with. In this decade, some artists are wising up to this fact that pitch correction ain't all that it's cracked up to be. The Getaway by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, for example, features Anthony Kiedis' natural pitchiness, which we really haven't heard that since One Hot Minute in the mid-90s. Pitch correction raises a few telling aesthetic issues. With the sheer volume of music being produced, released, and streamed on a daily basis, there seems to be a bias toward over-tuning vocals. The issue is whether the tuning will smear you into the crowd. A natural, well-sung, untuned vocal is a remarkable thing. So much so that it would certainly help you stand out among a bunch of robots. The second issue with pitch correction is whether a singer who relies on autotune should be making music in the first place. Pitch correction allows a competent singer to complete a polished vocal in, say, a third of the time, fixing a word or two here or there. But autotune can also allow someone who can't even carry a tune to pass as a singer. A third issue with pitch correction is how to use it in a way that is responsible while still maintaining a level of artistry. At Two Egrets, when I've produced vocals, my process has been to first inquire if the singer desires pitch correction at all. Then, once we do singing, I'll form a composite from five good vocal takes. Then we'll listen to the vocal composite together and determine what, if anything, should be tuned. Some genres like EDM and modern country require heavy tuning. Sometimes, if you don't tune an otherwise excellent vocal, the client will raise serious reservation about it. But in other genres like folk or acoustic-based music and punk, autotune is best applied sparingly, if at all. I've always enjoyed listening to complex and non-traditional harmonies. The opening of Love, the Cirque du Soleil remix of Beatles songs, continues to make me stop in my tracks when I hear it. The close, dissonant harmonies all over the album Frosting on the Beater by the Posies is a good reminder of what kind of magic can happen when singers are good enough to track together. If you've ever heard the track Solar Sister, it's worth a listen. It's amazing. Also, there are groups like the Jayhawks and the Teenage Fan Club are able to blend harmony and melody in an indistinguishable ball of yarn where if one part is absent, the whole thing doesn't make sense. Having a sense of music theory informs how to create harmonies that convey the feeling you want. Thirds are safe. Fourths are weird. Fifths sometimes go too far. Sixths are cool. Seconds and major sevenths are dangerous. Three-part harmony is, of course, a matter of taste. Sometimes it's just too much. Other times it's not enough. The best project with three-part harmony that I've worked on even recently was Kaylin Roberson, who she was 17 when she recorded vocals with me for her single Run Back to You. She overdubbed three parts in a way that seemed effortless and natural. And when I asked Kaylin how she came up with the part, she told me that she'd spent years in a barbershop quartet. As far as how to construct complex harmonies, a barbershop quartet is probably the best place to learn. She did a great job. Range and power often concern singers. Much of our professional livelihood depends on being able to hit that note with sufficient volume. I noticed a general improvement in my range and power in 2003 when I spent a good effort and a good amount of time getting in shape. Cardiovascular exercise, as well as good nutrition, gave me more vocal stamina and gave me a note or two greater of range and more vocal power. And that makes sense if you think about it. I mean, the body is a system of organs. If all is working well, the vocal cords work well too. The Mike Garrigan Podcast is brought to you by MikeGarrigan.com.